Good evening and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I'm Lynn Curtis, curator of exhibits at the club and co-chair of the club's member-led arts forum. I am your chair for today's program. We also welcome our listeners on the radio, and we invite our audience to visit us on the internet at www.commonwealthclub.org. And now it is my pleasure to introduce our speaker, Stephen Bauer, Artistic Director of Bradbury and Bradbury Art Wallpapers. Bradbury and Bradbury Art Wallpapers is a small East Bay area company founded by Bruce Bradbury in 1979. It specializes in hand silkscreen wallpapers reproduced from and inspired by historic patterns ranging from the 1860s through the 1960s. A number of those patterns are on view here today. Bradbury and Bradbury wallpapers have been used to restore state capitals, museum houses, governor's mansions, bed and breakfasts, restaurants, train cars, travel trailers, and most importantly, hundreds of thousands of private homes all over the United States and abroad. Their work has also been used in dozens of films and is frequently featured in home and fashion magazines. Stephen Bauer, Bradbury and Bradbury's current president and artistic director, took over the business in 2005, rising from a position that he refers to as an upstart teenage drafting apprentice in 1982. Since taking over, he and his staff have broadened the range of the company's collections to include patterns from the Art Deco, post-war, atomic age, and 1960s mod generation wallpapers, while continuing to add to their existing Victorian and arts and crafts offerings. I now present Stephen Bauer.
Well, I was hoping to talk about clean coal, but they told me I'd have to talk about wallpaper. So, it's probably true with most of us that we maybe have spent more time scraping old wallpaper off of walls than ever really stopping to think about where wallpaper came from or what wallpaper's all about. And that's understandable if you haven't devoted a lot of time to it. Because historically, most wallpaper has been intended to be just simply as used as a background, just sort of playing a supporting actor role in the rooms that we occupy, just a benign sort of backdrop to more highly esteemed works of art, the kind they put in frames, or just as a background for more important elements in a room like draperies and furnishings. So we don't necessarily think about it even though it's so ubiquitous. Well, unfortunately, though, some of the wallpapers that we do notice, those are the kind that haven't been really content to play that supporting role as an actor. Each of us, I'm sure, can recall sometime in our past some wallpaper that yelled and screamed and jumped to the center stage out into the lights and demanded all the attention in the room. It might have been the loud colors in it. It might have been the wild pattern in it or the chaotic rhythm that it had, or maybe just some unforgettable motif that it used or theme to it. Maybe it was just plain ugly, as many wallpapers are. Well, those kind of wallpapers, unfortunately, have left many people with pretty indelible impressions in their memory. For example, in 1880, author Thomas B. Aldrich, in The Story of a Bad Boy, he penned this recollection of the bedroom wallpaper that he had as a child. He said, "I never had a chamber all to myself before. Pretty chintz curtains hung at the window, and the pattern of the wallpaper left nothing to be desired. On a gray background were small bunches of leaves, unlike any that ever grew in this world. And on every other bunch perched a yellow bird, pitted with crimson spots, as if it had just recovered from a severe attack of the smallpox." There were 268 of these birds in all, not counting those that were split in two, where the paper was badly joined. And then the writer George Plimpton, back in an interview in 1987 on public television, He recalled, he said, "I remember the wallpaper in my bedroom in Paris when I was 5. Those giraffes." And negative reactions to wallpaper have been even more dramatic, like the last words of the playwright, author, and poet Oscar Wilde, who was reported to have said, "My wallpaper is killing me. One of us must go." And one of them did. Well, the wallpaper was later arrested and taken in for questioning. But despite Wilde's assertion, though, the wallpaper had not, there's no evidence that the wallpaper had anything to do with his death, but obviously Wilde found the pattern to be pretty objectionable. So rather than being offensive, though, some wallpapers may actually have inspired and fired the imagination of people, even writers. This was no doubt the case of the writer of a spine-tingling story found in a 1950 issue of Weird Tales. It was entitled Potts' Triumph. It tells the story of an arrogant decorator by the name of Philander Potts, who is hired to redecorate the room of an old house that was owned by two old eccentric spinsters. Well, after removing the very stubborn French wallpaper that originally hung on the walls, suddenly the Potts installs the new paper, and immediately after which, well, the decorator himself disappears, and his small figure is to be seen only by those with eyes to see, imprisoned in the intricate pattern of the wallpaper. What a way to go. And who of us can forget, I don't know if you appreciated in the 1970 movie Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory, the lickable wallpaper. Remember, the strawberries taste like strawberries. The snozzberries taste like snozzberries. So pretty exciting memories of wallpaper over the years. Well, how do you feel about wallpaper? Well, I would imagine that if most of you being here, if you're here to hear a lecture about wallpaper and to see an exhibit of wallpaper, then you may be, as I am, appreciative of the virtues of a nicely papered wall. You may feel that a well-designed wallpaper can be a wonderful means of artistic expression, and you may understand the way that it can communicate with others in the room as a very powerful, even giving a powerful signature identity to a space, and often in a more expressive way than furniture or draperies could ever do. But it's interesting, though, that there, even though there seems to be a lot of wallpaper hanging in the world, and a lot of people use wallpaper, buy wallpaper, install wallpaper, that most of us really know very little about this very common form of decoration as wallpaper. So I thought it might be a good idea to discuss tonight just some of the frequently asked questions that we've gotten at our factory over the last 30 years of producing wallpaper. We've had a lot of groups come in and individuals, and some questions keep coming up every single time. So I'm going to discuss some of those. The first one is probably an obvious one. When did people start gluing walls or gluing paper to their walls to decorate them? Well, no one knows for sure who really invented wallpaper, although the wallpaper manufacturer, a great French wallpaper manufacturer in the 18th century named Jean-Michel Papillon, credited his own father, Jean Papillon II, with its invention in 1688. But the use of wallpaper or use of paper, though, as a decoration on people's walls may go back much, much farther, maybe even to the ancient Chinese. They may have invented it since they seem to have invented everything else anyway. And may even go back to the ancient Egyptians, since a roll of a sort of wallpaper was actually found in Tutankhamun's tomb by Howard Carter. It was back in a corner next to a large jar of pickles that his Aunt Agnes had given him to eat on the way to the afterworld. So that's kind of interesting. You know, may have quite a long history. But in modern times, however, by the 16th century, some Europeans were beginning to take small decorative sheets of printed paper and attach them to their walls either with glue or nails to create a decorative effect. These kind of fall under several categories. One is lining papers. These were decorative papers most often used to line deed boxes or chests back then. Well, some individuals took those and attached them to their walls with some decorative effect. Also, there were marbled papers. We've probably seen those in the insides of many older books. Well, those had come from Persia, and they took the Europeans' fancy, and so many were also using those for wall coverings, and very extensively in some cases. Then also there were woodblock prints, just decorative woodblock prints. People found interesting and began to put those up on their walls as well. And as interior archaeologists have gone back, they found some of these papers that where the scale was rather large, and it was obviously part of a repeating pattern, which indicated that some of those papers may have been produced with the idea in mind of becoming wallpaper. And that was something that they imitated from printed textiles at that time, the large repeating pattern sort of motif. So those have been found as well. And for cost saving, some of those woodblock prints or those prints were printed on used paper, sort of an early version of recycling, because paper was very expensive back then. And a sad account that illustrates the perils that were sometimes incurred with this practice of printing on used paper was the tale of a printer named Herman Schinkel from Delft in the Netherlands. He was convicted of printing and then publishing books critical of the Catholic Church and was summarily executed in 1568. Well, during the interrogation, he had claimed that the material that they found was actually printed by a servant of his, someone else, and that upon his discovery of them, he had thrown them into a corner with the intention of printing roses and stripes on them, making them wallpaper to paper addicts later on. Well, they didn't buy the story, I guess. Well, and then there were, along with those, there were many other early decorative papers that were imitations of more expensive, luxurious items. For example, there were flat-printed but beautifully figured wood grains. And it's funny, I mean, that's wood grains and some of these imitations of materials, well, those are something that you find in wallpaper books from the 16th century all the way to our day still. It was a popular sort of a trend. But some of these were very beautiful, very convincing wood carvings that were printed on paper, paneling, entire wainscots, prints that simulated the inlay of exotic woods, and all of these, again, very well done and very convincing, especially when they were put on the ceilings or higher parts of the wall. It was pretty hard to tell the difference between the real thing. And then there were fuzzy, you know, those flock papers, those fuzzy papers. You know, flock papers were made long ago, and they were usually made to imitate silks and velvets and more expensive hangings. Well, flock prints were originally, they were printed with a wood block, as we'll talk about later. They'd print the pattern in a sticky varnish, and then they would use chopped wool and scatter that over the pattern. Well, the first of these, of course, were a little crude, but eventually the technology, as you might say, or the practice or skill got to be to such where it was difficult to tell which was the textile and which was the paper. So they got very, very good at creating these early flocks. And again, that's a type of paper we still see today. And then there were mock flocks, which sounds a lot like mucklucks, but they won't keep your feet warm. Mock flocks were actually, again, they were printed like the flock papers, but instead of chopped wool, they would scatter pigment, coarse pigment over them. And again, they came out with pretty impressive looking. Well, again, many of these early decorative papers were made to imitate something more than they were, just paper, which, of course, only served to get wallpaper off to sort of a bad start, you might say, less than a credible start as a decorating medium. And I mean, after all, who would want to admit that their expensive wood paneling or wood inlay or their beautiful velvet hanging was actually just printed paper, right? I mean, that'd be pretty embarrassing. So it didn't give wallpaper a good reputation from the beginning. But that didn't stop some manufacturers from continuing to produce these imitations of papers of other materials, especially the undisputed wizards of wallpaper, the French. Well, they printed those papers for years and years. And in fact, by the late 19th century, Lewis F. Day, who was one of the great British wallpaper designers, he, like many design reformers of the 19th century, he criticized this continued proliferation of these imitated sort of papers, or these three-dimensional looking papers, or these mockeries, as they called them. When he wrote in 1904, he said, equally bad offenders are the French, who seem to have no other ideas of a wallpaper than to make it look like damask, lace, embroidery, mosaic, painting, tapestry, no matter what, so long as it has no character of printed paper. But the fact is, though, that the French were very, very good at printing these types of papers and creating them, and so there was always a market there. But, of course, it wasn't only Lewis F. Day that criticized the French for these 3D effects in paper, especially after the English and others began to jump on the bandwagon to produce them also. But by the 1850s, British design reformers like Augustus Welby Pugin, Owen Jones, John Ruskin, all of them began to complain about the these types of papers and began asking the question, why are we printing, why are we trying to make two-dimensional walls into three-dimensional panoramas or imitations of things? So they complained about that pretty vociferously. And it was starting to get out of hand after all, so they had to put their foot down. So the reformers, their strong recommendation was to take pattern back to the Middle Ages, back when flat, stylized ornamentation ruled as king. And so their criticisms were heard, and as a result, wallpapers from that time on, many of them began to be produced as flat, ornamented, stylized type of wallpapers. We start to see a lot of those by the late 19th century and printed to a much higher standard than they were after at that time also. So great wallpaper designers and advocates of these reforms, like William Morris, we have a paper of his in this collection. He produced papers that became some of the most highly praised and highly prized papers of the time. So they really, these reformers really turned the tide in the way of design. And they paved the way for simpler styles and patterning for wallpapers to come in years following. Well, of course, as time went on, however, some party poopers in the crowd thought that even a little ornament was just too much. And the cry went out for even less ornament or none at all on your walls. Paint was considered to be better, or plain walls. Austrian architect Adolf Loos, for example, wrote an essay in 1908 entitled Ornament and Crime, Ornament and Crime, that contributed to the modernist idea that ornamentation was just superfluous and should be suppressed or left out of an interior altogether. Of course, you can't keep a good wallpaper down, as we see around us. And despite the attacks from critics on pattern and ornamentation at the beginning of the 20th century, wallpaper designers and manufacturers, they kept giving the people what they want, beautiful wallpaper. And just warms your heart, doesn't it? So basically, that's how wallpaper started and progressed in a very nutshell sort of form, starting with those single decorative sheets and evolving in time to more familiar types of wallpaper and rolls and such that we're familiar with today. But another question that we get at the factory, have been asked over the course of time, is how do you make wallpaper? That's funny. You know, people will say, you know, I see wallpaper, but I never thought about, like, where does it come from? How do you make wallpaper? Well, we at Bradbury & Bradbury, for example, we use hand silkscreen printing. It's a method that I'll talk about here in a minute. But the oldest method that's still used by some companies, though, for printing wallpapers is a traditional woodblock printing technique. Now, what is woodblock printing? If you're not familiar with it, there's one description. It goes like this. You take a block of wood. It's often a fine-grained species like sycamore or pear wood, for example. And it's nailed. That wood is then nailed to a wooden backing, maybe a cheaper wood like pine. Then the image to be printed is then drawn on that finer grain wood, and then it's carved so that the design remains in a higher relief from the rest of the panel. Thick lines in larger areas of the design are done that way. They're carved in the wood. But for finer lines and dots in the design, copper strips or dull pins would be driven into the block used to render those finer details. Well, the block then was then charged with color by flipping it over and lowering it onto a felt that was saturated with ink. So you think in principle like a rubber stamp, right? The inked block was then lowered onto the paper, and then some pressure was exerted on it, usually by mechanical means, although in some factories in the past they would hire young boys to go up and walk around on the top of the blocks. And maybe it was that even distribution of the weight or whatever, but or cheap labor, who knows. All right, where were we? Okay, so the boys were removed, the block was lifted, and voila, you had an image printed. So then the process was repeated. You would have another repeat, another color, one by one, each block printed until you had a roll of paper, a continuous roll of paper. So, of course, you know, generally speaking, it took one block to print one color for each repeat. So you think about it, with all of that labor, say if you're looking at a wallpaper that has 30 colors in it, well, you can begin to imagine the amount of labor that went into producing that wallpaper. Tremendous amount of labor you may not be aware of. And so block printed wallpaper could turn out to be a very expensive commodity, very labor intensive, but very beautifully done. The French, again, they really excelled at that. And the French wallpaper company, Desfossés, for one great example, in 1861, well, they had created a 23-panel scenic wallpaper, approximately 12 to 13 feet high, 23 panels. And that landscape, scenic landscape, took an astounding 3,642 blocks to produce. And it may have taken months, and in some cases with some of these scenics, years to produce a room of that paper. So very expensive. So we didn't see much of those happening after the 1860s. It just got to be too expensive. Well, of course, as the middle class grew during the early 19th century, manufacturers needed to respond with more efficient ways to print wallpapers other than woodblocks, right, to meet that demand. So through trial and error, the earliest mechanized printing for wallpapers was developed by the 1840s. Printing was done using engraved rollers. The first of those were made out of metal, and then they went to wood with, again, copper or metal strips driven into them. And the first examples of these first mechanized papers were pretty crude. The colors were not very many, or they were few in color, and the motifs were very small. But by the 1850s and 60s, well, they developed a technology to where they were pretty outstanding-looking papers, and the quality was much better. In fact, by the 1860s, 24-color wallpaper printing machines were not uncommon. So they got pretty good at it within a generation. Well, later, after the Second World War, another method was used as the demand for wallpaper began to slow down and more experimental designs and ideas were being used. That method, which we use for our production at Bradbury & Bradbury, is the silkscreen printing method. Now, a silkscreen is essentially a stencil, and I brought an example with me over here. It's not an ugly wallpaper. This is actually a silkscreen. As you can see, it's a frame, and that frame is stretched with a monofilament polyester fabric. Now, that fabric, of course, is porous, what we do then is we take a photosensitive emulsion in a dark room, and we skim a coating over that fabric. From that point, after that dries, we lay an opaque piece of artwork over that. It's usually an opaque image on clear film. We lay that on top of it and then expose that to an ultraviolet light. Now, what the ultraviolet light does is it passes through the clear parts of the design It sets that emulsion and turns it into a permanent stencil, whereas the part of the emulsion that's behind the opaque artwork remains water soluble. And so after the image is exposed to an ultraviolet lamp, it's then washed with water, and the image itself washes out and it leaves a stencil. It's pretty impressive. The Japanese really developed that, but wallpaper manufacturers began to use it in earnest by the 1940s for smaller runs. So that's how we do it. One, like block printing in a sense, one color at a time, one repeat at a time as we work down our 92-foot-long tables and produce rolls of wallpaper. That's how it's done. It can be very labor-intensive, but the advantages of silk screening for us, like many small producers, one is that it's less expensive to develop a new design. We don't have to engrave new rollers or carve wood blocks for them. It also allows for smaller runs that would be too expensive to tool up for. Some large companies could never afford to do some of the papers that we do because we do such small quantities. But that's where silkscreen allows us to produce a wide variety of patterns in very small quantities. And it also gives us a faster turnaround time for printing. Also, the oil poster colors that we use to print with can be mixed to be very much more vibrant than mechanical process inks, and a little bolder if necessary. And they're also applied, you might have noticed from our book back there, they're applied much more evenly than the way colors are applied mechanically. If you look at some of the wallpapers, you'll see in the exhibit here, you'll see what we call smushies or smush effects, so the ink is smashed together. Well, those papers are printed mechanically, and the ink is wet. So that ink is being constantly reapplied, or colors are being reapplied on top of wet ink, and so you get that kind of smushed effect. Well, silkscreen, each color is laid down after the previous color has dried. So we get a nice, clean, crisp sort of image that way. Well, since World War II, other methods were developed for use in printing wallpaper. One was photogravure printing, which some of you may be familiar with. Uses metal rollers that are photochemically engraved. They have little tiny cells in them of a regular size, and the depth of the cells controls the intensity of color produced. Each of the rollers are then charged with color by an ink roll or a spray, and then a doctor blade scrapes the surface clean, leaving the color just within those little tiny cells. It then turns, that roller then turns against a rubber roller, which presses the paper, which is passing between the two rollers, and the color is printed. So that's photogravure printing. The other method is called flexographic printing, which is essentially the same as the old surface printed, you know, the original mechanical means of printing, with engraved rollers, but it uses rubber rollers and it uses oil-based ink, whereas the old printers were originally done with distemper inks, which were water-based. So since these two methods, the flexographic and the photogravure, since they lay down less ink on paper, they dry faster, and so they can run paper through there faster, they use less ink, and so since the 1960s, those have been the two methods that most wallpaper companies, the high volume ones, have chosen to use for their method of production, and they produce very efficiently. Again, in a nutshell, that sort of tells you how wallpapers have been made over the years, those various methods. Well, another question that's often asked is where do designers get their ideas for wallpaper? What are their inspirations? Well, as you can see from the examples hanging on the wall in this exhibit, they draw their ideas from all kinds of sources, all sorts of inspirations. But if you were to narrow it down, you could find probably four common categories for wallpaper designers' inspirations. The first is they look to the outside world, and what I mean is faraway places, like things that would offer an escape from the everyday world, people living in their smaller homes or may not have the means to get out as much. It offers them escape into faraway places that are more exciting and exotic than what they have at home. World travel themes, for example, tropical paradises, ruins of the ancient past, even foreign street scenes have all been produced over the years in wallpaper and to great acclaim. Then also another inspiration is the natural world, of course. You see many examples of that here. Inviting the outside inside, you might say. Floral papers, lush landscapes, birds, clouds, trees, and like one of our most popular patterns, a midnight blue background with gold stars randomly sprinkled across it. Well, people love that pattern because it may remind them of just a lovely night sky while they were camping or some romantic notion like that. But, you know, those simple things, bringing the outside in, have often are an inspiration for wallpaper designers. And then, of course, there's traditional patterns. You know, that's the designers always have this safe fallback that people love the classics. They always do. Stripes, florals, damask patterns, which are currently a popular trend. Classical motifs, they always seem to be in style. And so it's kind of like the saying goes, what's old, you know, is new again. What goes around comes around, sort of, so to speak. Well, these interpretations of old ideas, though, they often come with new twists, you know, just to keep them fresh. Like, for example, you might see 17th century or 16th century damasks sold now that are in black and white, which you would never have seen in the original colorways. Or you might see them in like a shocking pink. Well, actually, they did do some of that. But producers did also commonly in the 1960s, they'll take a Victorian-era pattern and they'll color it psychedelically. And I slipped and said we, but we did do that. In our book, you'll notice a pattern in there called Carnaby that was actually designed in the 1860s by Owen Jones. And it is actually a reproduction of a paper from the 1960s. And what they did is they resurrected this pattern from Owen Jones, and they put psychedelic colors to it and called it new. And guess what? It sells. Because people like that. And they liked it in the 60s, too. So, again, traditional ideas, but putting a new spin on them to make them fresh again. And then another, the fourth inspiration is just popular taste. You know, whatever's in fashion at the moment, well, wallpaper manufacturers, like other retailers, well, they'll respond in kind. Pop culture has always been big, cartoon characters, hobbies, sports, decorating styles from Europe or Asia have always been popular, or just the trend of keeping up to date, making your home look modern or contemporary. That's something that's always sold well and had great appeal to the market, and so wallpaper producers are always producing these things too. Now, when it comes to inspiration, though, wallpaper designers, we kind of have our hands tied somewhat by several restraints that other graphic artists or other fine artists aren't necessarily restrained with. For example, wallpaper designers, well, we have to cater to a large market, so not just to a single client or a very small group of people, but we have to consider a larger market if we're going to be able to spend the money to produce a product. And they have to take the decoration of entire rooms into consideration. Some wallpapers are sort of prima donna-like. They like the attention, but a sensitive designer will consider other things that a person may have in the room along with the wallpaper, if there is. Maybe you don't want to put anything else in the room after you hang the wallpaper. Some of it's that good, but you do have to take that into consideration. They also have to think about how designers have to think about how certain motifs will look when there's dozens of them repeating across a wall or a ceiling. I was visiting with a nice lady earlier who was talking about the difficulty with samples. You know, you get a sample in the mail of a wallpaper, and you look at it and say, well, how's this going to look? Well, wallpaper designers, they're not designing samples, right, you know, like those early decorative papers, but rather they have to think in big terms. And so For example, on our website, we try to provide some vignette shots of showing the wallpaper in repeat. We try to provide some larger samples. There's different means. It's not always possible to show every pattern in repeat, but wallpaper designers have to think in those terms. And so sometimes a wallpaper that may not be too impressive, you know, in a sample form, well, it may turn out to be a very beautiful and very effective paper once it's repeated 1,000 times across your wall. It's designed that way. Designers have to be judicious in their use of colors and harmonies, color harmonies, because, again, the principle of repetition. And along with that, they have to design with a limited color palette that's set by the manufacturer and with dimensions set by a manufacturer's equipment or their production methods, just like you can see here with our silkscreen pattern, this example of Marigold by William Morris, a 19th century pattern. We couldn't really make it a lot bigger than that or a lot longer than that, or it would be difficult to hand print that, have an individual do that. So there's those constraints. But it's these limitations, that make wallpaper design challenging are also what give wallpaper some of its unique characteristics and power as an artistic expression in the end. Well, we'll take our last question. Is that okay? One more? Okay. So here's a big one. Is wallpaper an art form or is it just a cheap form of decoration? Well, it's been both, hasn't it? We've seen that. It's always been an expensive means of cleaning up a room, hiding flaws, cracks, stains on a wall, renovating tired space or whatever. Cheap decoration. It's always been like that, though it's kind of debatable whether some of those early papers we talked about that people had recollections of, if that could be called decoration. But, you know, somebody must have liked it and hung it, so sometimes it is. But on the other hand, wallpaper also has been a powerful art form. For an artist, wallpaper can be a very large medium, you might say, a huge canvas in which to exploit the principles of color and pattern on a much larger scale than a framed picture could ever do, really, unless, of course, it was wall-sized. Artists as diverse as the likes of Albrecht Dürer, Walter Crane, Louis Comfort Tiffany, Charles Birchfield, and Andy Warhol have all manipulated the repetition, the color, and the repeating principle of a wallpaper pattern to very successful effects and with great success. William Morris, who we mentioned earlier, and other well-respected design reformers and architects also of the Victorian age turned their attention to wallpaper as a wonderful artistic vehicle for enhancing the quality of one's life and home. They considered it almost a moral virtue to hang wallpaper in their homes. For instance, in speaking about the process of designing wallpaper, Morris said, and Morris, if you're not aware of his work, he was a very successful wallpaper designer. Morris said, "Some beautiful piece of nature must have pressed itself on our notice so forcibly that we are quite full of it and can, by submitting ourselves to the rules of art, express our pleasure to others." And later he added, "Whatever you have in your rooms, think first of the walls, for they are which make your house and home. And if you do not make sacrifices in their favor, you will find your chambers have a kind of makeshift lodging house look to them, however rich and handsome your movables may be." And we agree, don't we? Well, and when done well, wallpaper can rise to a wonderful level of beauty. And in fact, so much so that in some cases it can begin to blur the line, you might say, between the industrial arts and the fine arts. In fact, during the early 19th century, French scenic landscapes and floral papers had reached such technical perfection in their atmospheric realism and their botanical detail that fine artists of the time, easel artists, well, they expressed openly their concern over the security of their own livelihoods. The wallpaper scared them. You know, it was getting that good. They wondered how long it was going to be before they were out of business. Well, imagine that. So how could how could a small painting on canvas hope to compete with a giant scenic that was beautifully rendered in beautiful detail and over, 10 times the size? Well, it'd be hard to imagine. So that's so the appeal of wallpaper continues to be undeniable. Here we are in 2009, in this technological 21st century, in the middle of a dismal economy, and people are still, thankfully, buying wallpaper. And in fact, it's enjoying something of a comeback right now. You might read in the magazines or say wallpaper's back. Well, that's exciting for those of us who make it. And we're not talking so much about the mass-produced stuff, with the blurry images of flowers that are unrecognizable, but rather the artistic products of smaller companies who still esteem their craft and the papered wall not as just a cheap decoration or a means of cheap decoration, but as an expression of art and design that can be lived with comfortably and enjoyed for many years to come. As the Times of London put it many years ago, few occupations can satisfy so swiftly and completely as papering a room. The man with the brush and stepladder has the feeling of creating a work of art. It should live at least for a year or two, and if covered up then by layers and layers of later work, as many of them are, may come to a kind of concealed immortality, unsuspected until future generations digging about in the ruins discover his wallpaper and wonder how he did it. Maybe now you have a little bit of better understanding of how he did it, how we do it. And we hope you've enjoyed this discussion and the exhibit of Bradbury and Bradbury's own discoveries about in our own ruins, so to speak. And I did want to mention that I probably haven't covered every question that we've been hit with at the factory. So we do have a few moments for extra questions that I could answer for you. And I think
okay.
Mrs. Curtis has some for us.
Right. Thank you. Wonderful.
Oh, you're welcome.
Thank you very much, Steve. I'd like to remind our listening audience that this is a program with the Commonwealth Club of California, and you are listening to Stephen Bauer. Some of the questions from the audience. One is, have you reproduced all of the papers that are hanging here today?
No.
No. And which ones have you, and do you do that on request?
We have produced some of these. If I go down the line here, we've produced the lily frieze, the galleon frieze, the one called the Berkshire, which we call Idlewild, the river frieze back in the corner, the one with the sailboat. Let's see, as I move along, we've reproduced the one we call Atomic Doodle directly in front of me. And I can't remember what's out in the hallway, but I don't think we reproduced any of those. We have reproduced papers upon request. It depends on the number of colors and the work. As I described, it's very labor-intensive. Sometimes that can be expensive. But we've also we've had individuals bring us papers that were exciting enough to us that we reproduced them without any cost to them. For example, the frieze over there called the Berkshire, the woodland sort of frieze. We had a client in Kansas that sent us a black and white photo. This was on our blog, by the way, from their 1904, I think it was, dining room. Yes, thank you. And the black and white photo showed that frieze. And one of our designers said, hey, that looks like something we have in our archives. And we pulled it out, and lo and behold, it was the same frieze, which is pretty astounding, considering there were thousands of friezes like that printed back at the turn of the century. So we ended up reproducing that for them, and that was pretty exciting. So Sometimes we do that. If you have anything in particular in mind, I'm not sure who asked the question, but you can see me after the lecture, and I'll be happy to talk about it with you, and I'll talk about you too.
Yes, I'm combining some of the questions. What are some of the historical places that you have papered or gone in to restore?
Wow, I don't have a list, but many governor's mansions, state houses, museum homes, all over the country and around parts of the world as well. We've done, all sorts of historic buildings. We've been doing some hotels, historic hotels in New York that are becoming sort of like boutique hotels, they call them. Let's see, did I leave anything out? We haven't done the pyramids. We're working on that. Many, many historical structures all over. I wish I had a list. We should put one together. It'd be pretty lengthy.
We've been in a couple that you have restored, and I noticed that they had, it's not just one wallpaper. You might have 8, 9, 10 different wallpapers in the room going up the walls and the ceiling. Is that correct?
Yes, but not all at one time.
Yes. Oh, but really? Not all at one time?
Well, we have produced some pretty elaborate room sets, we call them, and they're compositions of papers, very much like the ones that were produced in the 19th century that had at least three papers on the wall. A dado, the lower wall, was called a dado, then the center part of the wall, which was referred to as a filling, and then above that a frieze. And then on the wall, or on the ceiling, rather, there may be a number of borders and a ceiling fill as well. And that was very typical of late 19th century decoration. So,
do you have the ability to produce wallpaper with a customer's design?
Yes.
Yes. Okay, yes.
Yes, we do.
Okay.
We haven't done a lot of that, but...
Uh-huh. But you have, you would...
We have, yes.
We have done that.
Yes.
Okay. On one of the papers over there, I think it says the word sanitary or mm-hmm. some. What does that mean?
That's a good question. Sanitary papers were something produced in the late 19th century. As I mentioned earlier, early wallpapers were printed with distemper inks, which were used binders of glue or other things, and they weren't water soluble, so you couldn't wash them. Well, there are all sorts of articles written and concerns about the cleanliness of wallpaper. You can imagine with gas lights or with coal stoves and all of that. We'll have to talk to the clean coal gentleman or panel in the other room about that. But it soiled the papers, and there's nothing you could really do about it. And so there was this hue and cry over the course of time in the 19th century about diseases and pathogens and all sorts of things hiding behind wallpapers, all really great stories. None that I want to tell here, but anyway, what happened was that they started experimenting with sanitary or washable wallpapers. That's all that really means. Some of those were printed with varnished inks, which weren't so good. Some of them were varnished after they were printed, or may have been printed with oil-based inks and then varnished after that. And some of those sanitary papers proved pretty successful. They were often printed with fine engraved rollers, so they look a little different than some of the papers that were being block printed. Most block printed papers were not sanitary, but anyway, so that's what happened. And they were the forerunners of washable, scrubbable vinyls that came out in the 1960s.
You say that wallpaper is coming back, and
yes.
Given
Real
the
big.
New. Is there a new design or style that's developed now that you have not seen before in the past? I mean, is there a way to describe the return of the wallpaper? Is it just looking back, or is it really creating something new?
That's a good question. It is somewhat retrospective. Wallpaper... The way wallpaper sort of come back, I think, is, again, through... the use or the experimentation by smaller companies of ideas, again, that weren't necessarily different than what you had seen in the past. They were sort of just reinterpretations of of things that people hadn't seen for a long time, especially pattern, because, you know, through the 20th century, there was a real fear of pattern and color. People were painting their walls white, and they really hadn't seen it. It was sort of a novelty. And so when people began to produce papers that weren't just muddy textures or just, you know, blurry roses, it excited the interest of writers who began to talk about it in magazines, and it really spurred more of an interest in it that we've seen in recent years because of people being willing to look back and see what was done and actually resurrect some of the work of designers past, but then again to also reinterpret those and be willing to do so without worrying about playing it safe. That's sort of what became the downfall of a lot of wallpaper manufacturers over the last 30 years, was compromising the product for a mass market to the point where, you know, the papers weren't interesting anymore. You go through books and books these days that some decorators may have, and the papers just aren't exciting. And they're not exciting because the companies aren't willing to take risks. It's too expensive. So smaller companies have really been willing to do that and sort of reinvigorated the, I think, that's my personal opinion, reinvigorated the market for wallpaper in recent years.
There's a question about the paper. One is, what is the rag content? I'm not too sure exactly what that means. But also, if you could tell us a bit about the paper, because you're printing on 92-foot long tables. What kind of paper? Where is it coming from? And if you could give us a little information on that.
Well, we print on several different types of paper. I'm not sure what the rag content is, to be honest with you, of all of them. Most of our paper comes from back east, from some of the old mills that have been there for some time. There's very little vinyl content or anything like that in our papers, just enough to give them strength. But they're mostly rag papers, and I can't really tell you a whole lot. And they do come in big rolls. We don't print single small sheets, but they come in large 300-foot rolls, bolts from back east, and we roll those out onto our table. And so our factory can hold 92-foot long tables, so we can print six rolls at a time. So if you order six rolls of paper from us, many times you'll get a six-roll long bolt of paper. But that's not always true of most companies. That's just our unique setup that we have back in Benicia. I don't know. Did that answer the question?
Yes. What has been considered the wildest wallpaper ever produced?
Probably something Andy Warhol did. Maybe his cow wallpaper or his Mao wallpaper. You know, and then he hung his own portrait and things on top of it. As far as I know, there've been some pretty wild wallpapers over the years, but those stand out.
Now, didn't Queen Victoria have quite an elaborate wallpaper for her walls, but that you reproduced?
We did reproduce a paper that Queen Victoria did use in her throne room at St. James Palace. It was designed by William Morris. 17 colors, and I wish I had a piece of it here. I didn't bring any, but it's beautiful. It's on our website. You can see it, but it's a fantastic pattern, very elaborate Victorian-style damask with roses and gold and silver in it. It's a pretty beautiful paper. And after he printed it, you know, it was an expensive paper to print because it was woodblock printed. And so over the course of time, those blocks, what happens to wood blocks is that they'll begin to shrink and expand, and whatever metalwork is in it will fall out. So those blocks have to be remade. And apparently the blocks for that paper were not remade after several years of it being printed for a few customers. So when we reproduced it, the reason we reproduced it, we originally got the commission back in 1983 what's his name, the guy that did Star Wars? Oh, yeah, George Lucas. George Lucas wanted a phenomenal wallpaper for the entry hall of Lucas Ranch, which is, I don't know if you've ever seen it, but it's a giant neo-Victorian. So he wanted something for this two-story high stair hall. It's kind of a funny story because we were pretty new, you know, so pretty poor, so we were pretty excited to have this commission. And so Mr. Lucas saw the picture in a book, and I'm not sure if my boss, Bruce, had showed him the picture in a book, but he liked it. Well, Queen Victoria is good enough for me. So we started to reproduce it, did the artwork, and but he was very particular about the colors. And Bruce, you know, tried to produce something that looked like the original, but he didn't want something that looked quite like the original. So Bruce had to tweak the colors. So he would do a strike off or a test print, all 17 colors. He'd run it over to Marin. He'd have 5 minutes with Mr. Lucas, you know, walk in, show Mr. Lucas the pattern. No, I don't like the blue. I don't like the red, or I don't like whatever. This is a story I've heard. So Bruce would roll it back up, go back to Benicia, do another strike off, make more color adjustments, run it back to Marin. So this was kind of going on back and forth for quite a while until finally Mr. Lucas was off on a trip to Japan. And he wasn't available to make any more decisions, so he was going to send somebody over to the factory and see if they could work it out. So Linda Ronstadt showed up, and so she was very great, very, very pleasant, wonderful to work with, and she helped make some decisions. Well, in the end, Mr. Lucas didn't choose that paper. He actually chose a tone-on-tone sort of pink on a lighter pink the ceiling paper to cover the walls with in there. But the good thing is that he paid for the development of this particular wallpaper, and so we still produce it today. And it's a very beautiful paper, and we're very thankful to him for subsidizing that for us as a very tiny company. We appreciate it very much.
Thanks, Stephen. I think this brings us to the end of our program now. So I'd like everyone to thank Stephen for his comments today. And we also thank our audiences here, as well as our radio audience. And now, this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, commemorating its 106th year of enlightened discussion, is adjourned.